Welcome to the podcast, Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, your host, and our focus is on mastering communication as an essential leadership skill so that you can command the room, connect with the audience, and close the deal in any context. After over 200 episodes, we are a top 1% podcast globally, thanks to you. So if you love listening to these conversations as much as I love sharing them with you, please take 30 seconds to leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or just go to the website, ratethispodcast.com/influence, and follow their super simple instructions. Now, on with the show. My guest this week is Patrick Lencioni. Does that sound familiar? He's the founder and president of The Table Group, but most notably, he's also the author of 13 best-selling books, most of which you've not only heard of, but have probably read, including The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team and all the books that go along with that, and most recently, The 6 Types of Working Genius. He sold over 9 million copies total, and they have been translated into more than 30 languages. He's also the host of the popular business podcast, At the Table with Patrick Lencioni, and right now he's at the microphone with us. So, Pat, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be on here, Laura.
Tell us a little bit about the 6 types of working genius, because it was only recently that I learned about this new book, and it's fascinating. I took the quiz, I read the book, highly recommend it to everybody else out there. So there's a quick plug up front, but give us a sense, what are the 6 types of working genius and where did it come from?
Well, this came about 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago, by accident. I was just trying to understand why I was grumpy at work a lot, even though I loved the people I worked with and what I did. And I'd come to work all excited, and I'd get grumpy, and people said, why are you like that? And this had been going on for 20 years. And I was like, I don't know, but I'm tired of it. I want to figure it out. And it led me to think, by the grace of God, like, oh my gosh, there's different things that have to happen at work. And I keep getting drawn into the ones I don't like. Mm. And why is that? And so I figured out there's 6 different things that people have to do at work. And 2 of those 6 are geniuses. We love them. We get fed by and energized and joy out of those. 2 of them we're okay with. 2 of them we hate. And they drain us of our energy. So I just did this to solve a problem for myself. I started sharing it with other people. It became universal, like this is real. And so now 1 million people have taken this assessment over the last 3 years. And it's growing like crazy. And one of the guys in my team who has your same working geniuses, Laura, he said, this is going to be bigger than the 5 dysfunctions of a team. And we're convinced that it's growing faster than anything we've ever done.
Well, I'm going to help it go in that direction. Highly recommended. So do you want to run through, or is that too much of a spoiler to tell people what the 6 types are?
Oh, no, we love to spoil. Because we love the book that people can read about it. But the assessment is even faster. It takes 10 minutes to fill out. You get your results right away. And basically, the 6 types of working genius, the first one is the genius of wonder, which is some people love to ponder things. They love to ask questions like, why is the world the way it is? Is there a better way to do this? I wonder if we shouldn't rethink this. That's a genius. A lot of people who have that don't even know it's a genius. The next genius is the genius of invention. This is one of mine. Oh my gosh, I want to come up with a new idea out of nothing. I love when people say, here's a problem. You get no structure. And I want to come up with an idea out of nothing. I do it all the time. I can't help it. Even when it's not necessary, I do it. That's why it's a genius. The next one is the genius of discernment. This is gut feel and instinct and pattern recognition and intuition. There are people in the world without any expertise, you can ask them a question and they can assess something and you go, why are you usually right? And it's like, because I just get things. I see the connection between things and it's a real genius and you should know when you have it because then those people are really the sources of advice that a lot of people go to and say, hey, how should I do this?
And of course, that's different from those of us who just always think we're right.
Well,
we need to, if those are the hard people to argue with because they are actually right.
Those well,
are the
ones yes, that like. Those ones, I saw a TV show, I don't know, somebody said, it must be difficult to be right all the time. Like they were making fun of somebody and they said, oh yeah, it's so hard.
Yeah.
But you have the genius of discernment. And so it's like, your gut feel is usually right, Laura.
Frequently.
And then there's the genius of galvanizing, which is your other one. And that's people that love to rally the troops. They get people moving. They're like, come on, we got to do this. They love to inspire and sell and motivate people to take action to improve their lives.
Yes.
And that's the genius of galvanizing. The next one is the genius of enablement, which is a good thing. Not enabling in a bad way. It's a good thing. These are the people that love to come alongside and say, yes, I will help you. They get joy and energy out of being needed and asked for help. Mm. Now, I don't have this and I feel really guilty. But when somebody says, will you help me? My first question is, well, how do you need my help? And let me make sure it's the right thing. And can I invent? Some people just love to be the one to say, yes, I'm there. They volunteer and they help. They're the glue on teams. and it's a genius. It's not just because they're nice. It's a real God-given genius. And the last genius is tenacity. Mm. And tenacity is the genius of liking to finish things. Neither you nor I have this one, Laura. We love to start things, but not finish things.
Yes.
And people say, well, how can you not have tenacity, Pat? You've written 13 books. And it's like, because the people around me have a lot more tenacity than me and they force me to.
Yes.
And that's good.
Yes.
So some people love to get up in the morning and cross things off a list and finish things and drive things to completion. Not me.
And the beauty of
this is we need each other.
Yes.
We need to be on teams where we leverage one another's gifts. So that's the six types of working genius.
And that whole who, not how piece. We can't do all things. We're great at starting things, great at writing books, but we need other people on our teams who are going to finish all of the legwork. I love making lists. I just hate actually having to cross the stuff off of them.
And you know something? Here's the thing. One person's trash is another person's treasure.
Yep.
Because I love coming up with stuff from scratch. So I immediately assume other people do too. And I've gone to people at work and said, hey, here's a project. Figure it out on your own. Do whatever you feel like. And they're like, no. Give me parameters. Give me instructions. Right. Give me guidelines. And I'm like, why? And I realized, oh, that's what feeds them. They like that.
Yes.
I don't. And so we tend to think everybody else is like us, but they're not. And that's a great thing.
So I'm going to recommend one more time to everybody, go out, whether it's in Audible, in Kindle, or paperback, the six types of working genius. Strong recommendation.
Before you even do that, just take the assessment.
Oh, good. You can do that first. Excellent.
Yeah. You go to workinggenius.com and in 10 minutes you take it and you get the report back and you're like, holy crap. No wonder I fail when I do this. And no wonder that works out well. And no wonder when I'm at work, I don't do well on this and I do well on that. And share it with the people you know. It's going to change the way they look at you. So it's great.
I think it is a great fodder for discussion because it like taking Myers-Briggs or the DISC profile or the Enneagram, you know, once you sort of understand your inner workings and where you do and don't share those preferences, of course, it's not your identity necessarily because we all can do things that we don't prefer when necessary.
Sure.
But to your point, what brings us energy versus what just sucks the energy out of us, sucks us dry.
And that's what makes this different because I love all those tools. I love the Myers-Briggs. I love the DISC. And all those things. But the difference between this and those is that this one is the closest to the ground, like what you like to do. Because like I'm an ENFP, you're an ENTP. What does that mean? It means lots of things. But it never said when you take a job or you take a role on your team, you should probably be doing this kind of work if you want to be really successful. And this one is really close to the actual work at hand, which is why teams reorganize like 15 minutes after doing this are like, oh my gosh, we have this person in the wrong job. Mm. And so that's one of the unique things about this. Those other tools are wonderful, but they do a different thing.
Yes. And that's why we want a tool belt. That's more than just a whole bunch of hammers, right?
Yes.
We need different tools to do different jobs. So this is a great one. Everybody go say the link one more time, Pat.
At workinggenius, two G's in the middle, .com. And everything is right there.
And of course, we'll put that in the show notes as well. So if you're driving or walking the dog or something, you don't need to worry about pulling over to write those down. Definitely come back, check it out, workinggenius.com. So what I'd like to do from here actually is to go through, if you have not read this book, you have to read this one too. I don't care which one you do first, but unless you have a preference, Pat, but the five dysfunctions of a team, what makes teams large or small fall apart. And of course, that's the root of companies as well. A company can't do well if the teams aren't strong within them inherently. So I want to look at those, but specifically from a communication angle. So I'm going to ask Pat to go through what those five dysfunctions are to look for and what's a trigger, meaning when you hear someone say something like X, Y, or Z, that should ring a bell. That should throw up a red flag for you. That makes you go, ooh, that sounds like dysfunction number two, that was this one. So because awareness is the start of all change. If we can't identify, if we can't recognize something when we see it or hear it, well, we're just going to keep spinning our wheels and doing the same thing over and over, wondering why we're not getting better results. So how does that sound for you as a game plan, Pat?
Sounds great. Sounds great. Let's do it.
Awesome. Okay. So dysfunction number one, and this is something where I recommend everybody come back later on. If you are driving or walking the dog, come back later. Take notes on this stuff and then go, of course, through the book. Dysfunction number one is absence of trust, correct?
That's right.
So what does that mean? And what do we listen for that should be something that makes that siren go off in our heads?
Well, you know, when we talk about trust on a team, it's what we call vulnerability-based trust. Mm-hmm. Because it's not predictive trust. It just means I've known you for a long time, Laura, so I can predict how you're going to behave. Vulnerability-based trust is a kind of trust that comes about when people say things. And here's the things you're looking for. the good sign is when people say things like, oh man, I think I screwed up, or that's my bad, or, you know, you're smarter than I am. Can you teach me how to be like you? Or here's the powerful one. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I think I was a jerk yesterday. I'm really sorry. When people say those kinds of things, of course, it needs to be sincere, but people usually don't say those things insincerely. But that's what you're looking for. And when people are saying like, no, I don't think that's true. No, I think I was right about that. And it wasn't my fault. Those are the kind of things that are a sign that a person is not capable of building trust because they're not vulnerable. Because vulnerability is at the heart of this. It's like, can you be buck naked to the people on your team and say, I know that I made a mistake, or I know that I need help. That's another one. I need help.
Yes.
These are the kind of things you want to hear from people on a team.
So it's the ability to admit imperfection, whether it's future potential for errors or problems or gaps, or recognizing that something in the past did not go according to plan and taking ownership of that as examples, being able to admit it is really the issue.
Yes.
Okay.
And since all of us have faults, if you work with a person who very rarely says any of those things, that's a pretty dark pink flag, I think.
Yeah, I like that. It's a dark, it's not quite red, but it's dark pink. Better take off those rose-colored glasses and see what is really beneath it. So if you hear someone who's regularly using those denial phrases, or who's deferring or trying to pass the buck to somebody else, coming up with their excuses, and it's coming down from the boss, it's coming down from, what do you do? How can you respond to something like that?
Well, it depends, right?
Of course, it always depends.
It always depends. But I would say in my career, one of the most important things I did is I tended to challenge people in positions of authority in a very kind way, but I was very honest about it. Mm. And people would, I remember at this one company I worked at before I started my own, people would shove me in the CEO's office and say, you go tell him. Mm. And I didn't even work for him. And I'd say, why? And they go, well, he listens to you. And you know what I found? And this is about influence. And I could go into the CEO or to a person of authority and say, hey, listen, I'm not here to tell you that I could do your job better than you. And I don't want you to think I'm condescending to you at all. However, I see some things that I think might benefit you. And I want to tell you those because I think it could help you. Let me tell you, 8 out of 10 times, they were grateful. And 2 out of 10 times, they might have just said, well, whatever, and ignore you. But far more often than not, most leaders, most people, if you can go to them in kindness and humility and anticipate that it's hard to hear those things, and then tell them what they need to hear, they're going to say, hey, you come and talk to me anytime because I love the fact that the way you do this. Mm. So what I say is if you see a person doing that, I think it's okay to go to them and say, hey, you know something? Being a leader is hard. And I know this because it's been true for me too. But sometimes I think that if you were able to acknowledge when you had an issue or a problem or needed help or made a mistake, I think people would really admire you for that. And so I'm not saying it's easy, but I think it's something if you did that, it would be positive. Many people are going to go, hey, thanks for telling me because nobody else does.
Mm, it's lonely at the top, as they say. Nobody's willing to tell you the truth. Of course, you've got to be careful. You can't be an intern necessarily going up to the CEO and sharing these kinds of things most likely. But
oh, no, I'm talking about in the context of a team.
Sure, sure.
In the context of a team, but you still pull them aside and do it in a kind way.
Right. And that's really important to know. So there's a few conditions that you referenced that I want to make sure people don't gloss over. Number one, pull people aside. You're not going to throw them under the bus in public. You're not going to embarrass or shame them in front of everybody else. Number two was to start with the disclaimers of sorts or a contrasting statement. So I don't want you to think I'm saying this or, you know, look, I'm not in your role. I realize it's not, don't know how I would do it or it's not easy being a leader. I appreciate all that. So you're starting with that buffer to soften it a little bit, not just launching into, hey, here's where you screwed up.
Right.
You're giving them credit.
You're demonstrating humility and vulnerability yourself.
Yes.
You know, you're saying, I'm going to talk to you about something that's going to require you to be vulnerable and humble. But let me just tell you that we all need this. And I'm definitely not here to condescend to you. Oh, it just takes people like, okay, I appreciate that. So what do you got for me? Anyway.
And what if it's somebody who reports to you that you need to address this lack of trust with?
Even more important. You know, because find a time when you didn't do it. Say, you know something, early in my career, I remember there was a time where I felt afraid to make mistakes or to acknowledge when I was wrong. And so I didn't do it. And I found that people saw it. They saw when I made a mistake. And if I didn't admit it, I actually lost credibility. And so I learned this the hard way because it's not natural. It's hard. And I notice sometimes I think that you might be struggling with that. And if whenever you're in doubt, go ahead and be vulnerable, because people will trust you more and I'll admire you for that. But just know, I'm not saying it's easy, because I made mistakes like that and somebody pulled me aside and helped me with it. So I want to do that with you. Very different than, hey, you're not admitting you're wrong.
Right. Why aren't you taking responsibility for this kind of stuff? And I would imagine that it's something that they would be better able to receive if they've seen you model it first.
Oh, goodness gracious. Yes. And if you don't do it ever and you tell somebody else to do it, maybe you should go to them and go, hey, you know something? I don't do this either. And it's really bad. And I want to get better at it. I'd like you to work with me on it too. Let's work on this together. Then again, you're being humble enough to say, hey, it's a struggle, but I want to get better at it. I'd like you to do it with me.
Okay. So there is absence of trust, dysfunction number one. Dysfunction number two is the fear of conflict. Now, there are lots of people out there who are conflict averse. There are others who I think are conflict magnets. So it's maybe a different kind of a problem at that point. But what's a trigger to listen for? Look, nobody likes, well, most people, I would think, don't necessarily enjoy conflict or seek it out. Unless it's a particularly bad day and they just need to unload on somebody, which is a whole other kind of problem. But what's a trigger to listen for to let you know that this is an active habitual dysfunction as part of the culture of an organization?
Right. And by the way, Laura, I would say 97% of the time, it's fear of conflict, not too much conflict.
Okay.
You know, when you think about TV and movies, we see people all at each other's throat. Well, in my career over the last 30 plus years in working with teams, it's almost always that they don't have the kind of conflict they need to have. And they're nodding and smiling and affirming one another. And then they go out in the parking lot or in the hallway and they say what they're really thinking.
Yeah.
So a lot of times people go, well, we don't want to have too much conflict. And I would say, hey, that's a high class problem for most organizations.
Yeah. You got a long way to go on that road. Yeah. You're safe.
So you know what I think you should look for? Now, I just thought about this, is what they're saying when they're not in the conversation or the meeting. Listen to what they're saying in the hallway or in the parking lot when they're like, oh, I can't believe they said that. And it's like, well, did you say that during the meeting? And they're like, no, I'm not going to say that. So it's like most meetings I go to, people smile and nod and seem to be agreeing. And frankly, it makes meetings very boring. And you're sitting there thinking, does anybody else think what I'm thinking? I guess I'm the only one. When you hear people outside of the meeting saying the truth about what they feel, that's a sign that there's not good conflict in your team. And again, I would just say, most of the people listening to this are going to go, oh, I hear that all the time.
Sure.
And what I want us to hear is people saying during meetings like, hey, I got to tell you, I just don't agree with you. And they're going to be uncomfortable. Even that comment right now, Laura, even if somebody said, hey, I saw a movie last night and this is what it was and I liked it. People don't even want to go, oh, I didn't like that movie. That feels like, oh, that's uncomfortable. How about when they go, well, here's my budget plan for the year. And I want to hear more people going and saying, hey, this is not easy to say, but I just disagree. There should be a lot of moments like that in meetings, because that's when really good things happen. And it is so uncommon. And it's one of the biggest problems we have in our society and in organizations, is that we don't know how to disagree. But here's the deal, Laura, it's all predicated on there being trust.
Yes.
If there's no trust, people aren't going to disagree, because they're going to be like, well, if I disagree with them and we don't trust each other, then they're going to feel like I'm coming after them or things like that. So anyway, I think that trust precedes conflict, and conflict is usually uncomfortable. And it's people, when they engage in conflict, are usually like, oh, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I don't agree. That's a really good thing.
And again, you just put in a really good little prefacing phrase to help soften it a little bit. Like, I can't believe I'm saying this, or it's a little weird saying this, or whatever. So you're buffering a little bit. And note the tone of voice that comes along with that. And it's that balance between what you say and how you say it. You're not necessarily just coming in and saying, I so disagree with you. You couldn't be more wrong. You're not coming at it with a sledgehammer. No. Maybe you can, I suppose, if it's whatever your relationship with that person is. But it's really both the what you say and how you say it, the gentle angle to it, I so appreciate this. You know, here's a thought. The but maybe is a word to watch out for too. When you start with something nice and then transition with the but, they go, all right, here it comes. Now, what is it? Then the wall goes up. So if it is your boss and the boss is conflict averse, how do you handle that?
There was a book written years ago by Terry Pierce, who's passed away, called Leading Out Loud. And I loved it. And he talked about how anticipating objections is always so important. It always rang true with me. And so you could say in a meeting like, hey, I might be wrong, but I think that this might not work. Or, hey, I don't want you to feel like I'm being difficult, I just feel like this might not be a good idea. And that leading statement is like, hey, you're my boss, and I know that you have a lot more experience than I do here. So please understand that. I want to acknowledge that. I'm just not sure this is going to work. That preface is so powerful.
Yes.
Because you've just said, I'm giving you permission to disagree with me.
Sure.
About how I'm disagreeing with you. And that makes all the difference. Leave that out. And it's like, I just don't think this is going to work. Now they're like, whoa.
Right.
But just say, hey, I could be wrong here. I'm not sure this is the right solution. And here's why.
Yeah.
Totally makes a difference.
Do you find it also makes a difference if people, rather than the sort of the blanket, you know, yay or nay on it, if they draw attention to like a factor that they might be more concerned about? Like, so I might be crazy about this, but my concern is with topic X, or, you know, how does that affect this? Or what about this piece of it?
Yes.
Wouldn't that sabotage the whole thing?
Yeah. In my examples just now, they were obviously hypotheticals but sure. The more specific you can be, like, I'm just not sure that we're going to have the money in the budget for that program when it comes around next year. I'm not sure that's going to work. That's a lot easier for somebody to go, well, I might be wrong, but I think this is terrible. You know, it's like, how do they even respond to that?
Right. So that lacks that whole subtlety piece. Yeah. But the idea of starting with those contrasting statements that you also mentioned, if anybody out there, another great book is The Crucial Conversations.
Right.
They talk about things like, please don't think I'm stepping on your toes, or don't think that I'm just trying to be argumentative. So I'm not, it's not X, but Y. Yeah. So I'm not doing this. I just want to draw attention to this one piece over here. So helping people to get in and not be afraid to have healthy conflict. I think that's really the key.
Exactly.
Isn't it? The healthy conflict is necessary.
And remember, when there's trust between the people on the team, they're going to take that for what it is, which is an honest statement. If somebody doesn't trust you and they come up to you and then you know you don't trust them, like if this were in Congress and people were like, well, with all due respect, that's just the
FU. Loaded.
You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
But when there's trust and you say, oh man, I say this with respect for you, and you know that there's that vulnerability-based trust, you're mm-hmm. like, oh, I appreciate that. So without trust, none of this advice makes a lot of sense.
Right. Okay. So then how about dysfunction number three, lack of commitment? What does that sound like?
Well, that's when people, so I love this. In Japan, if you were to work with a Japanese group of executives, mm-hmm. and you had a conversation and somebody made a proposal and they didn't like it, they would go like this. Hi, yes, hi. Mm. Or if they hated it, they'd go like this and they'd suck through their teeth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, that's a sign in Japan that they're not on board, right?
Yeah, not going to happen.
So it's going to depend on the culture. But what you don't want is people going, so we're going to do this plan, right? And you don't want people going, yeah, okay. That's like, no. You want to go like, hey, I realize we might not have agreed about all this completely. We've talked about this, but we've got to break the tie and we've got to make a decision. Is everybody in? And you want people looking you in the eye, nodding their heads and saying, yes, I will do this. Yes, I'm in. Most times though, what we find is we have this passive commitment and you kind of know, like, they don't look excited about this. And that leads to alligator arming, you know, like the, oh, let me help you with that.
Right. Short arms, deep pockets.
Yes. Or people watching things happen in the organization and saying, oh, this is going to be a nightmare. Just watch. Those are the kind of things that, oh, no, no. That means that people aren't truly committed. And we have to get real commitment. That's why conflict is important, because if people don't engage in conflict, you don't know where they stand. And so at the end of that conflict, you can't turn to somebody and go, okay, Laura, I know that you didn't like this part of the budget or this thing over here, but we need you to commit to this. We're going to do our best to make it work. And we heard you. And Laura can go, yes, okay, I'm all in. You heard me. I will do this. Without conflict, you don't get accountability.
Right.
You get people nodding their heads and smiling and going, okay, I'll do my best.
Yes.
And it's not going to work.
Yeah, we'll try. That's we'll do another cross-cultural one. The in Arabic, they'll say, you know, God willing, the inshallah. It's like, sure, we'll try it. Yes, God willing, that's what will happen, which means this is not going to happen. Yeah, sure. If God wills it, it'll be there.
In fact, we heard this story about this big name brand company that was doing work in Japan with a partner. And they had a guy that spoke Japanese on the phone. They were based in Seattle and they were doing a partnership in Japan. And they suggested the idea. And then all the people in Japanese part of the Zoom call were like speaking in Japanese. And then they came back and they said, we will do our very best. And they finished the call and everybody's like, yes, they're in. And they turned to the interpreter and they said, what were they saying? And they were saying, there's no way this is going to work. But in a Japanese meeting, you just don't say no.
Right.
So like you said, that's the same. It's like, hey, we'll do our very best.
That's a lesson I had to learn a number of times. I lived in Japan for a number of years, and learning to interpret the different kinds of yeses and the different kinds. No, it's usually rather than a direct no, it would be the literal translation would be, it's different, as opposed to directed. They do have the word no, it just doesn't come out nearly as often as we say it here. So to everybody else out there, have you noticed that there is a pattern of building? These are not just like, well, you could have A, like you're not dealing out five random cards from the deck. It's that commitment is number three, which is built on number two, which is conflict, which is built on number one, which is trust. You can't have three without two, and you can't have two without one. Ergo, you can't have three without one. And we have two more on that. So am I connecting the dots correctly?
You're totally right. And we always say, start with trust. Always start with trust.
Yes.
Because without trust, conflict and commitment don't happen.
Yes. Building that house on sand.
Yes.
Okay. So let's jump in then. In number four, dysfunction number four is avoidance of accountability, which I'm going to guess is also predicated on having the commitment and the conflict and the trust and all that kind of stuff.
Yes. And if people all haven't committed to what they're going to do, why would they hold each other accountable? It's like, well, what am I holding you accountable for? But if it's either the behaviors we've agreed to or the plans we've agreed to, whatever we've committed to and left that room saying, yes, we're all in. Well, it would make sense that if there is real commitment, there's a much more likelihood that people are going to turn to somebody and go, hey, I thought we committed to that. Why aren't you doing that? And this happens in every kind of team where ultimately it comes down to people calling each other on things that they see going on. This, by the way, Laura, we have an online team assessment that people take around the five dysfunctions. The lowest score overall, not on every single team, is this.
Really?
People just don't like the idea. It's one thing to disagree with somebody. It's another thing to turn to them and say, you need to do better. Or you need to change your behavior, or you need to change the way you're approaching this. This feels so untenable to people.
Especially with a peer, I would imagine that, like, who am I to tell you? I'm not your boss. You're not my boss. How can I, just to turn to somebody else and say, you need to step up your game on this.
I love that you just said that, because the funny thing about it is the boss should not be the primary source of accountability on a team. Mm. They're the ultimate one, but the primary source of accountability should be your peers. Like on any great team, and if you think about it, like if your firefighter's at a fire, nobody's going like, that guy's not getting the ladders fast enough. I'm going to go talk to the boss. You're like, get the ladders here, damn it. You know,
right.
In the emergency room at a hospital, or soldiers on a rescue mission or something like that. Whenever there's a crisis, people know that they're meant to hold each other accountable. Mm. And yet that should exist in every kind of organization. The difference is the stakes are so high that people are not worried about offending somebody by turning them. So if a team has made a decision and the boss said, okay, this is what we're going to do. If you see your peer straying from that, how much better is it to go, hey, buddy, hey, dude, hey, lady, what's going on? Am I missing something here? Is that better? Or is it better to go to the boss and rat them out and have the boss go to them and go, hey, somebody said you're not doing your job.
Right.
And now there's politics. On a great team, the best teams, people hold one another accountable most of the time.
So how can you do that? How do you talk? What's a good phrase to use to not make it seem like you're overstepping your boundaries, not make the other person feel embarrassed for something? If you realize somebody's dropping the ball on something they need to, what's a good way to approach a peer about that?
I would say, hey, Fred, I might be seeing this wrong. And if I am, please forgive me because I don't want to offend you. It just seems like the thing we agreed to. Are you struggling with that, or is that not happening? From what I'm looking at, I'm wondering if you're struggling with that. And by the way, if you thought I was doing that too, and if I'm wrong, please call me out on it, because the last thing I want to do is be judgmental.
Right.
Fred's going to go, oh no, you're right. I've been kind of dropping the ball on that. Or, oh no, that, if it does, do you think I don't think so. And you're going to be open to that. It's just having the conversation is the thing that people don't want to have.
Right.
Like, am I wrong, or are you not delivering to the numbers that we had? And are you going to be challenged for that? Because if so, I'll help you figure this out.
Right.
Those are the kind of conversations. And here's the kind of classic ones, because most of accountability, Laura, comes down to behaviors, not numbers. Behavioral accountability comes first. So imagine you're at a meeting and you say to somebody after the meeting, hey, Bob, come here. I might be the only one who thinks it, but I think sometimes during the meetings, you do a lot of the talking. And I know you're extroverted and you do all that. But I wonder if it might be good if you didn't ask more questions.
Hmm.
Now, oh my gosh, most people would rather tell somebody they had bad breath than have that conversation.
Yeah.
And yet the best relationships come from people who are willing to have that conversation with each other, as long as there's trust and healthy conflict and commitment. And it's like, hey, you know, we talked about acting like a team more, maybe. And by the way, is there anything that I could do better?
Right.
Is there anything I could do better? I'm going to give you permission. Like, maybe I'm not doing the right thing during meetings,
sure.
Or maybe I'm wrong.
And if it is one of those things where you have to manage up again, what's a good way to address the boss if there's an accountability issue? Maybe they're too much on the iteration side or with their various geniuses. A lot of wondering, but not a lot of execution, and even of the stuff that they're supposed to have not delegated necessarily.
You know what's funny, Laura? That's so interesting that you said that. You're good at this. When you know one another's working genius or their Myers-Briggs or whatever else, you can actually call them on things safely by just pointing out something they already know.
Yes.
So I don't have any T in tenacity, right?
Okay.
Which means follow through and finishing things. The most junior person on my team could come to me during a meeting and go, hey, Pat, it looks like you're not paying attention to the deliverable. I know that you don't have tenacity, so you can lose sight of that. I'm thinking that we might want to talk a little bit more about where we stand versus the deadline. And I would go, what a great application of something you already know about me.
Yes.
Other than that, it feels like a huge judgment of me as a person. Like, hey, right. you're flaky, you know?
Right. Or we're going to have to pick up your slack again.
Right. Or hey, you know, you guys, I have wonder, and so please forgive me, but I'm not sure that we stop enough to actually ask the question about whether this is still the right thing in the market. Suddenly we have a context for saying something, for holding each right. other accountable, and people are going to go, good for you for doing that, because you're right. I'm not good at that.
Right. It's a way also acknowledging somebody else's strength in the process. If they're particularly good at discernment or they're particularly good at innovation or something, that there is to acknowledge they've got great strengths in that area, which was really helpful in this area or it's what other part of the project. And just wanted to check, recognizing that the tenacity isn't there, the follow through, the attention to detail, deadlines, those kinds of things as a way to then couch and say, so recognizing that I'm more of a T person, you're less of a T.
Right.
I noticed X, can I help you with X? Or the help may be more of the E person, the enabler, but.
And Myers-Briggs is so interesting too, to even say to somebody, hey, I noticed during meetings you don't say a lot. And I know there's probably a lot going on in there. I know we've done the Myers-Briggs, you're an introvert. So that means you like to process things and think about them. So how can we help you speak up more so we don't miss out on what you're thinking? Because we know it's there. It's just, you're not probably going to fight to get your voice heard. That is very different than why don't you speak up?
Yeah.
You know, or, right. And other ones like feeling and thinking in Myers-Briggs, which you're an ENTP and I'm an ENFP. And the feeling part of me, people would go, you know, I'm not sure that you're direct enough, Pat, because I know you're worried about people being sensitive and you don't want to hurt people's feelings. Or, hey, Laura, I know that sometimes you come right out with that opinion, but there's a couple people on the team who get their feelings hurt. And suddenly it's not a character flaw. It's actually a discussion of how to use our unique skills and things. And so having the language, vocabulary, and handles like that makes communication so much easier.
So much more valuable. Absolutely. Dysfunction of teams, number 5, inattention to results.
Yeah.
What is it and triggers to listen for, where it's not just a momentary thing, this is an active, consistent dysfunction?
This is an interesting one, because when we talk about results, we're talking about the collective results of the team. And when you hear people talking about my department, my team, my budget, as opposed to the company, the whole organization, our thing. When they're saying, well, my employees feel this way. No, 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 those are our employees. In an organization, when people start to lobby for their constituents rather than come together to solve the problems of the whole organization, that's when you know that it's not about the collective results, but about the individual ones.
Mm.
And most leaders, Laura, if you were to give them a little bit of beer or truth serum, and say, what's more important to you? Tell me the truth. Is it the executive team or is it the department you lead? A lot of them will say, listen, I hire the people I lead. I sit with them. I spend more time with them. I like being their leader. I feel like I need to defend them.
Mm.
And that's the recipe for a very dysfunctional company.
Yes.
It's very natural and very common, but it's very dysfunctional. And that's why when people go to meetings, they shouldn't be talking about my team, my department, my function. They should be talking about the company.
Interesting. Okay. So then, when you do hear people talking a lot about my team, my department, my budget, my whatever else, I guess it's two different things. One is if you recognize that someone is coming to a higher level meeting, perhaps representing their team, not necessarily from the sense of I have to go to bat for my team, that people are walking all over my team, we're getting steamrolled, we're not getting the credit, we're not getting that we deserve, we're not getting the resources we need. If they have to do that, is that also the sign that the larger company is missing something?
Yeah, this is where the leader needs to call that person out and say, hey, I just got to ask you, you keep talking about your team and your department. Do you think that maybe you are more concerned with having to go back and justify the decisions we make here, and you're worried that they're going to be criticizing you for that? because we all need to be willing to do whatever we have to do for the good of the company. And if that means we have to go back and give bad news to our teams and explain it in the context of the whole organization, we have to be willing to do that. I'm just a little concerned. I'm hearing you talk about your department, your function, your team, and it's going to make all of us feel like we're supposed to do that too. I mean, just call that out.
Yeah.
And usually people go, gosh, I'm sorry, I'm doing that. I guess I do think about that. And yeah, it's kind of hard to go back and tell them that I might have to cut budget from their department, but it's for the right thing for the company. And then everybody can go, hey, we'll help you with that. We're all in this together. But you just can't let that whole departmental silos become the norm.
I think it would be important, if I'm hearing this correctly, to recognize a very fine line between someone who's not willing to be a team player, whose team isn't willing to play with a larger team in the organization, versus who, if somebody is saying, the company wants this as the goal, we need these resources, we keep getting promised these things, but we're not getting it, or you're pulling stuff away, we can't perform our larger organizational function without these things, that person who's going to bat for their team is not just being selfish, so to speak, it's that they're trying to, and there's a higher level dysfunction of disorganization or lack of commitment of those resources, that dysfunction number three, perhaps. Am I hearing that right, that there's that dangerous line there?
Yeah. In fact, everybody will say, we have a results issue. And it's like, no, let's pare this back. Mm. Do we have an accountability issue? Do we have a commitment issue? So somewhere down there, there's something else. We have to, it's like the mattress and the peas. Like, where is the pea down there that's causing this problem? But here's the interesting thing. I think if that person at the top is genuinely has good concerns, they need to say, hey, I don't want anybody to think I'm here to represent marketing. I really have a genuine concern because we are trying to do something for the good of the team. And it doesn't feel like we're able to do that. And so if you ever have any concerns that you think I'm just arguing for my people, let me know, because I promise I'm not doing that. See, and this is where the anticipating objections.
Yes.
The difference between saying that at the beginning of that conversation, saying, I know that this could sound like I'm being territorial here, and I promise I'm doing my very best not to be. I have a real concern. That is going to be exponentially more effective by having called that out.
Yes. And I think that's the key. I'm so glad we came back to that, because this goes back to whether it's a preface, whether it's hedging, whether it's contrasting statements, but it all comes down to anticipating objectives. Where can you, knowing that you're bringing up something that is potentially a little tense or sensitive or may make somebody else's wall or defenses go up, to be able to anticipate, okay, what's going to trigger that in that person? How can I preface whatever I'm going to say, point out, request, or else with them with some sort of a framing to get them off the ledge before they get on it?
Yes.
And to allow them to receive what I'm going to say without the defenses kicking in, be able to hear what we need them to hear. So to say it in a way that they can hear it, that anticipating objections should be a conscious step mentally first, then something that we are translating actively from, okay, I know they're going to object to this, so I have to say it using these words, avoid these words, be careful of my tone, my speed, my volume, my energy, all those kinds of things. So the delivery piece, and then go through with whatever we actively need to have as the core of that challenge that we need to bring up. Did I get all that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's exactly right. I love it.
I think that's the piece where most people will balk, because they're hearing all this going, yes, 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 we want to do these things. I don't know what to say first. I open my mouth and it just all feels icky, or it sounds great in my head, and then it sounded better in my head.
So, you know, it's funny. So I do a lot of public speaking, and I do the same thing in a public speech as I do if I'm in a group of people or one-on-one. And that is, I like to let people into what's going on in my brain, because right away they're evaluating me.
Yep.
And if I go to, hey, you know what I was thinking before I came out here on stage, or you know what I was thinking before the meeting today, or you know what I was thinking before we sat down here, I really hope that you understand that I care about you, or I hope you understand that when I come here humbly and I'm willing to admit I'm wrong, or I hope you yes. understand that I really want what's best for the organization. It's not manipulative if you mean it.
Yes. Yes. It's not manipulative if you mean it. I want to make sure everybody heard you say that. Yes.
But what's really terrible is if you really mean it and then you don't say it because you're afraid it's going to sound manipulative. Now you're actually reducing your ability to be effective.
Yes.
So if you mean it, say it, be vulnerable, and let them go, oh, because they're sitting down at that meeting, or they're in the audience and they're like, okay, we're going to evaluate, and just go, hey, you know, I'm kind of nervous. And whether I say that in front of 10,000 people in a speech or in a one-on-one, and I say, I'm nervous because I really hope that this doesn't come across this way, or I hope I don't do this or that. Suddenly people are now rooting for you. They're actually like, oh, thanks for sharing that. Okay, don't be nervous. Let's do this together. Yeah. Versus, I don't say that. I'm just nervous. And they're wondering, like, what is going on?
Right.
The funny thing is, when I say that, my nervousness usually goes away and it's a better conversation.
Yes, everybody can connect with you on that level. It's something we've all experienced. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. We need to wrap this up. Let me ask one final question because you seem to be the master communicator. Finish the sentence for me. I wish I was better at explaining what to whom.
Well, I'm glad you gave me a heads up on this but I know what it is. It's I wish I was better able to explain my thought process to my family, my kids and my wife, because here's what happens in my family. And this is my working genius. They'll say, hey, dad, X. And X leads to Y, leads to Z, which leads to A. And I go, A. And they're like, you didn't even hear me. And I'm like, I did hear you. And they're like, yeah, but where did you get A from? Right. It's like a chess match where I just go boop, 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 boop. And it's so frustrating to them, which becomes frustrating to me because I didn't take them through like how I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wish I were better able to explain my thought process to my own family so they didn't think I wasn't listening.
That's so important, isn't it? That people who, so many conversations go off the rails when one person thinks the other person isn't listening.
Oh.
If they're not, that's a whole other ballgame. But if some trigger, some cue makes you erroneously think that the other person wasn't listening, it's a grenade, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's my own fault. But what's hard is when they go, you're not listening. And then I get mad. I'm like, what do you mean? I can repeat what you said. But that doesn't matter. What it is, did you acknowledge that you heard what I said and connect me to what was going on in your brain? And I jump right to the solution. And that's kind of how I think. And I'm not good at taking people through that with me. So
we all still have something to learn, even after 13 best-selling books.
Yeah, plenty.
Thank you so much for being honest and humble and trusting us with all of your stories today, Pat. Tell us, how can people learn more about you and the Table Group?
Well, our website is tablegroup.com, just like kitchen table, tablegroup.com. And everything is there. You can even connect to the Working Genius stuff through there and books and other stuff about me and us and all that we're doing. Workinggenius.com. Two G's in the middle, workinggenius.com.
Love it. And I highly recommend it. So much fun. Really glad that I took it. I love taking those little assessments to get clear on what's really going on inside my head, that kind of where no one has gone before. So with that, thank you so much for joining me, Pat. This has really been a great conversation. And I know people are going to take tons away from it.
Thanks a lot, Laura. God bless.
And to everyone else out there, thank you, as always, for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if you love this show, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, your platform of choice, so we can help even more people to increase their confidence, presence, and influence. And of course, if you're not sure how to do that, go to the website ratethispodcast.com/influence and follow their instructions. And of course, if you want to download my free guide for equipment recommendations for virtual influence, including my picks for microphones, lights, and more, go to speakingtoinfluence.com. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, and you're listening to Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite.
Thanks for listening to Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite, the show for leaders who want to speak with impact. The hosts, producers, owners, and media distributors of the show make no guarantees that the strategies and information discussed will result in profit or other success and may result in losses. The opinions and statements of the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the owners, staff, managers, broadcasters, or sponsors of the show. No medical or psychological therapy or personal or professional wellness or relationship advice is offered in the show. You are advised to seek counsel on matters related to your health, family, relationships, job, or other business and legal matters from licensed advisors in those areas prior to making any changes in business or lifestyle. No information provided may be suitable in your situation. As always, take responsibility for the decisions and actions you take, including the reactions they may make in your work, family, health, and life.